You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. We're going to be talking about cosmology and the universe on its largest scales this month, but first let's check in here in the solar system. On Mars, we've got the two rovers that are currently there. We've got Perseverance, NASA's rover, which landed a few months ago, and that's also got its little helicopter, Ingenuity, which is flying around, for the time being at least, following Perseverance over the surface. We've also got the Chinese rover, Zhurong, which landed more recently and has been trundling around off its lander as well and starting its journey. So the first Chinese rover on the surface. Now, while the NASA rovers do selfies by holding up a robot arm, like a selfie stick, the Zhurong rover has done something different. It's dropped a remote camera on the surface and then driven back to the lander and onwards. So it's a bit more like, instead of the analogy of a selfie stick, the analogy of putting a camera on a rock or on a wall and then running back to join the group to take a group photo. So just a different way of doing it. Meanwhile, on Venus, we've talked about that in the last year or so, of course, because of detections of phosphine in its atmosphere. And this has contributed, I expect, to the three missions that have now been announced, two from NASA and one from the European Space Agency, ESA, to go and explore Venus in the coming years and decades. Launches are a little way off, but we have two probes from NASA, Da Vinci and Veritas, and one from ESA, Envision. And these are going to do a combination of mapping the surface, of studying the atmosphere, and even descending through the surface on a balloon to study the composition of the atmosphere in more detail. Slightly further afield, we've had the announcement of the detection of a new type of object by the gravitational wave detectors LIGO and Virgo. Whereas previously these detected pairs of black holes merging, and also a couple of examples of pairs of neutron stars merging, they've now found the third in that set, which is a neutron star and a black hole, or what appears to be a neutron star and a black hole, merging together. And they didn't find this just once, they found it twice. These mergers actually happened or observed within 10 days of each other back in January 2020, but the information has just been released. Hopefully, we'll be able to talk about that next month. So on to cosmology. We have a broad understanding of the history of the universe over the last 13.8, let's call it 14 billion years. It started with a Big Bang about 13.8 billion years ago, and everything expanded from this very, very hot, dense state, gradually cooling until the point that it stopped being an ionized gas, a plasma, and became broadly transparent to light. That point we can see by looking back in time over great distances as something called the cosmic microwave background, or the CMB. We understand the composition of the universe, at least in its broad scope. About 4 or 5% of what we, or what the universe is made of, is the stuff that we see and touch and feel. That's atoms and molecules, normal matter, if you like. About a quarter of it is something called dark matter, which is this mysterious stuff that we don't see directly, but we see its gravitational effect on the normal matter. And then finally, about two-thirds of it is dark energy, which is this very mysterious force that seems to be causing the expansion of the universe that's been going on since that Big Bang. It's causing that expansion to accelerate, which is very unexpected, or was unexpected when it was discovered. We'll talk more about what we understand about some of this in this program. I'm joined by two people who can help us understand this in much more detail. Dr. Samantha Stever did her undergraduate degree here in Cardiff before moving on to a PhD in Paris and is now an assistant professor at Okayama University in Japan. Dr. Ian Harrison, meanwhile, studied his PhD here in Cardiff before moving on to Manchester and now his current position at the University of Oxford. And I'm delighted to say he'll be starting a new position here in Cardiff later this year. I began by asking Ian to give us a 2-minute summary of how our understanding of the universe has changed over the last 100 years.
The foundations for understanding the universe in a scientific way was really about 100 years ago, when there was a nice confluence between, I guess, Einstein writing down his general theory of relativity, and people like Edwin Hubble were making observations. And once we realized that the universe was really, really big and also expanding, we kind of realized that that implied that there was this hot Big Bang model, which, you know, everything used to be really, really close together and really, really hot, because we can see now that everything is flying apart. So logically at some point in the past. It must have been much closer together. In the 1960s, there was the nice experimental confirmation of that from Penzias and Wilson, who detected the cosmic microwave background, which is the kind of first light left over from that hot Big Bang state. And through the 80s and the 90s, we slowly observed more and more of the galaxies in the universe and got an idea of what the structures look like in our universe when we started to see this cosmic web picture of how it looked. Since about 2000, in the past 20 years or so, we've really written down what that whole model is, containing that expansion history and that contents of dark energy, dark matter, and normal matter. And we've really seen things in the cosmic microwave background, measured that to the nth degree with things like Boomerang and the Planck satellite and the South Pole telescope and Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which mean that we have really high precision results and we're really confident in this. And now we're starting to poke into the unknowns which are still in that model about what dark energy and dark matter could really be.
One of the ways of thinking about observing the universe as an astronomer is that actually you're a time traveler. If you look at the sun, you're actually seeing it as it was about 8 minutes ago because the light has taken 8 minutes to get here. If you look at more distant planets, then it's taken more minutes, maybe hours to get here. And for the nearest stars, it could be years, hundreds of years. And for galaxies, we're normally talking millions of years for the light to get here, which means you're seeing them as they were millions of years ago. And as we look back at the distant universe, we're seeing it as it was billions of years ago. Now, this is a blessing and a curse. It means we can see things as they were a long time ago, but we can't see the universe here and where we are as it was billions of years ago. We can only see very distant parts of the universe billions of years ago, and we can't see those distant parts of the universe as they are now. So it is this blessing and a curse. And it does mean that we have to bear all that in mind when taking our observations.
It's both kind of an important principle in cosmology that you do not regard yourself as a privileged observer, we call it. We say that we start off with the assumption that we are a typical observer of the universe. And, you know, we say this is what those distant parts look like 14 billion years ago. But because all of the distant parts we see 14 billion years ago look like what we expect to have happened here 14 billion years ago, we say we're talking about the physics at this location as well. So it's absolutely the case that because you have this interplay between the space and the time and the light travel. So where we're sat now, 14 billion years ago, there was some cosmic microwave background light which was released. And 14 billion light years away in the universe, there could be some other beings like us who are having a conversation about the cosmic microwave background, but they're not talking about the cosmic microwave background light that we see. They're talking about the cosmic microwave background light that was emitted at our location in the universe, if you see what I mean.
It's certainly true that thinking about this too much can easily get your head wrapped up in circles if you're not careful. Now, Samantha Stever, you work on designing scientific instruments to go on satellites and balloon-borne telescopes and so on. Many of the discoveries we've had over recent years and decades have been via developments in technology or techniques to observe the universe. But lots of them have been very recent because this is hard. Why is this so hard?
If you're looking at the CMB, you're looking at the furthest away possible thing that you can observe in the universe, and you're basically looking through literally everything else in the universe. There's, you know, the giant, galactic center, the Milky Way, in which we're spinning around, and then there's cosmological foregrounds, like just all sorts of things emitting stuff everywhere that have to be taken into account. But with the CMB in particular, this pretty much was first discovered by accident, which I wish that we actually could accidentally discover wonderful things still, but I think we've discovered most of them. But yeah, going back to Penzias and Wilson in 1964, they were just trying to build a huge microwave horn antenna for measuring the signals that were being bounced off balloons. But, you know, they see this background at, I believe they said it was 2.3 Kelvin. And yeah, they said, we don't know what this is. And they went through, you know, they did the usual experimentalist panic, which is to look for every single possible systematic effect to, you know, explain this. They realized it wasn't the sun. You know, they went so far as to clean everything. They cleaned out birds from the horn antenna, right? And then, you know, it's kind of a very nice coincidence that somebody happened to be writing a paper where they were predicting that, you know, within kind of a Big Bang, hot Big Bang sort of framework, there should be this omnidirectional background radiation that would be around the microwave wavelengths. You know, and so it's like this serendipitous thing where they happened to measure something that actually makes, you know, it makes a lot of sense. It confirms a lot of theories. But, you know, moving into the future, you know, measuring this gets more and more and more difficult. Part of that is because, of course, on Earth, we have the atmosphere, which is going to, you know, it's going to add a significant systematic effect. And the atmospheric effects have to be taken into account in one way or another. And then on Earth, of course, you can't, you know, you cannot observe the entire sky. Your angular scales are going to be quite limited. So you're only going to be looking at a limited patch of the sky. And to understand certain types of physics, you have to be able to look at the full, you know, at the large angular scales. So, yeah, what has been developed from that? We started to put telescopes on balloons, which is quite nice. For instance, the Boomerang series of balloons. And that gives you, you know, that gives you the advantage of a larger angular scale and less atmosphere, not completely zero. And it is variable over the course of a balloon flight. But, you know, you can get a balloon back, you can improve its technology, and you can get a slightly cleaner observation than you can get from the ground. But the best way to look at large angular scales, which is what I work on, is to have a space telescope. So that is the advantage of giving you, you know, these large angular scales, obviously no atmospheric effects. The only trouble is that space flight is very, very difficult just by itself. Putting something into space is difficult. Designing something that doesn't break, you have to really be sure of everything.
The technology in the detectors themselves is pretty complex compared with what we're used to day-to-day here on Earth, and often involves running things at temperatures close to absolute zero. That's the zero point on the Kelvin temperature scale, the scale favoured by physicists. That's a staggering -273°C. Quite how complex is this stuff, Samantha?
This is really technology that is quite niche and is used by, you know, very limited number of people. Okay, maybe some Earth observation satellites, but for the most part, it's space telescopes. You really need to have very, very high sensitivity. And in order to get that sensitivity, you typically need to have a system which is measuring at cryogenic temperatures. And by this, I don't just mean like Kelvin scale, but actually, you know, down to 100 millikelvin or even less. And of course, this is, we're now at a point where we're not really limited by detector sensitivity anymore. We're actually limited by photon noise, which is just the statistical variance of photons being incident on something. You cannot get past that in terms of individual detector sensitivity. And, you know, so of course, the only real answer is to have more and more and more detectors. And they're getting up into, you know, thousands in space or tens of thousands on the ground in order to get the overall instrument sensitivity that you need. Those detectors need to be more and more cold. I guess in the case of ground telescopes, you can always go back and you know, fix something if it goes wrong. But we're really to the point where we need, you know, thousands and thousands of detectors. We need to know everything about them. They have to be tested quite heavily. And we have to completely prepare for each of these systematic effects, predict it, and learn how to mitigate it, really before we're looking at the data. You also have to somehow get that data back to Earth, right? And there's only a certain period of time where you can downlink all of this data. And when you have more and more and more data, you have to make kind of a compromise between what you're sending down and, you know, how much data you need, basically, that's finite. So, you know, it's a little bit like your favorite band comes out with a new album, and you're at home and you have only a 56K connection, but you really want to listen to this new album, you know? So you download it, but you downloaded it at a really terrible quality. Okay, maybe not terrible, but you have to compromise. If you want the high quality, you can only get maybe one song. So it's a little bit like this. And then, of course, that requires a dedicated study to see, does this really kill the data quality, or can we still get the cosmological parameters that we need from this? So yeah, it just gets more and more complicated. The complexity of this is really exploding in a large number of ways.
This complexity is really where there's that important interface between the people designing and building the instruments, like yourself, Samantha, the people analysing the observations, and the people developing a theoretical understanding of the cosmology of the universe as a whole. Isn't that right, Ian?
Yeah. And I was just thinking, that was an excellent reminder of why I think cosmology is so amazing, right? Because it ties together all of these really awesome things, right? From the technology of designing the detectors and cooling the detectors, to the space science of potentially getting them into space, to the sophisticated computing that we have to worry about to extract information from the data, the ones and zeros that come back from the telescope. And then we relate that to our knowledge of astrophysics, more local astrophysics, about our galaxy and the emission from our galaxy and stars and other galaxies, because that's the foreground emission that is in our way that we want to see behind, to see all the distant stuff in the universe. But we have to understand that to know how to remove it so we can see through it. Then you get to do the cosmology and observe the universe on its largest scales and learn about the history of the universe as a whole. But then the actual physics that you're interested in is sometimes really kind of incredibly small scale fundamental microphysics, because you're thinking about the physics that was around at the extremely high energy part of the Big Bang right at the start of the universe, when the universe itself was incredibly small. So yeah, cosmology is, I think it was probably one of the reasons why I got interested in cosmology to begin with, because as you say, and as Samantha was saying, the fact that you have to bring all of these things together in order to get the result that you're interested in, and you get to think about and have some contact with all of these different kinds of interesting topics is really awesome.
When I was an undergrad, cosmology was absolutely my favorite subject. But differently from you, I really prefer to work in the lab or on instruments. And, even just in that context, you really have to know lots and lots of different things. I mean, it's electronics, it's thermal physics, it's the way, working all the way up from this micro scale hardware all the way up into how this propagates the sky data. And that is really necessary for cosmology. And for me, at least, that's really a lot of fun. So I completely agree that there's many intermingling things that have to go on in this field. And you have to really have very good control over all of them.
You have to understand the detector physics really well, because the patterns in that, as they get imprinted on the data that comes back from the telescope, some of those instrumental effects within the telescope could fool you into thinking that they are these universe scale acoustic waves traveling 14 billion years ago. But because we can do these lab-based tests, and because we understand the technology well enough, we can understand well enough our instruments so that we can separate out those two effects, which would otherwise look very much like each other.
Yeah, I completely agree. This actually sounds a lot like what I specifically have been working on, which is the example of cosmic rays, because we're in space, at least in the case of my project, it's being done in space. It really has to take into account everything. You start really small, and then you go really big on the context of the CMB, and then you go back again really, really small to trying to understand these things that happened in the early universe.
Now, Ian, we talked about the model of the universe with a tiny fraction of it being stuff we can see and touch. But while we have a broad model that's described by maybe 12 parameters or numbers and a set of models to describe how the universe has changed and evolved, there are lots of developments that we're still trying to understand. What are the current mysteries in our understanding of the universe?
There are two very hot topics in observational cosmology at the moment. One of which is to do with the expansion of the universe and how quickly it's expanding. And the other of which is to do with how tightly and how smoothly the matter in the universe clusters and clumps together. So the first one is to do with the current expansion rate of the universe, which is the Hubble constant. And there's basically two very popular ways of measuring this Hubble constant, this number. One of which involves using the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, and you get a number which is 68 in some units. And then you can also measure that expansion rate directly, more locally. I say more locally because it's still on the scales of our galaxy and going outside of our galaxy. And if you measure the Hubble expansion rate using those, then you get a number which is basically 74. And of course, when we're doing science, we report our uncertainties on those numbers. And for a long time, the uncertainties on those kinds of numbers were large enough that these two things broadly agreed with each other within those uncertainties. But in the past 5 years or so, those uncertainties have basically been closing down. And it looks like there's a very consistent picture that one of them says 68 plus or minus one, basically. And one of them says 74.
If you go back maybe 50 years, we were in a very different place. Estimates of the Hubble constant, this expansion rate of the universe, ranged from 50 to 100 in the weird units that are used.
Yep.
And then towards the end of the 20th century, there was a general consensus that it was somewhere around 70, 75 or thereabouts.
Yep.
And now there's again real argument over which of those estimates that we have now, those more precise estimates, is actually right. Or, Ian, could they both be right in their own way?
It's not clear yet whether there are any physical explanations which are better than the explanation of the standard model that we have for our cosmology, plus some thing that the experimenters haven't and the observers and the theorists haven't understood about the data correctly between those two different experiments.
So Samantha, what's being developed in terms of technology and techniques to understand the universe? What should we look forward to in coming years?
What a lot of people are interested in, what most people are interested in, at least, you know, in my part of cosmology, is to measure primordial gravitational waves, which is a polarized signal in the CMB. But that signal has a magnitude of about 10% that of the CMB. It's incredibly small. In terms of the technology, we have to have detectors which are sensitive to polarization. Or another option is to have another way to kind of recover these polarization parameters from the data that you're measuring as your space mission or your balloon is scanning the sky. Ground too, actually. And so modulating the polarization so that you don't have to have twice as many detectors, because again, this comes into constraints of size, computing power, money, and so on, space, weight, all that stuff. So if you want to have not twice as many detectors, you have to have a way to modulate the polarization of the light that's coming into your spacecraft or telescope in general. You know, the thing about people developing space missions is that, in particular, space agencies tend to be very cautious about things that have not already been in space. At least in the case of the mission that I'm working on, there are developments of this rotating half-wave plate, which basically just polarizes the incoming light. It's the first thing that the light sees going into the telescope. And of course, as I said before, we have to go, you know, colder and colder. We have to find new detector technologies that are either easier to scale. So now we've gone into, for instance, we've gone from semiconducting detectors to superconducting detectors, which are more sensitive. And then we've gone from one superconducting technology to another one, which is easier to, you know, be read out with less stuff, less computing, less weight, so on and so forth. But, you know, all of these things are really challenges. And now is the time when we have really to have the most control over what we're doing, especially if we want to measure primordial gravitational waves, because they are tiny. There are many things that you have to be careful of, especially now.
I find it really fascinating that we're moving from an era where we're really figuring out whether any experimental effects mimic the signals we're looking for, to one where we're also watching out for other things out in the cosmos that could mimic what we're looking for as well. That sounds really hard.
That is something that's really cool because it brings the whole community together, you know, and that's really going to help us to evaluate, you know, is this a real thing? Is this not a real thing? So I think that's quite helpful.
Working together effectively is definitely one of the next frontiers in cosmology research. You know, one of the ways in which you can address this problem of astrophysical, by which I mean individual, you know, objects rather than cosmology being the universe as a whole, but the astrophysical effects can look like cosmological effects in some circumstances, is by combining data from very different kinds of telescopes, whether they're cosmic microwave background satellites or optical telescopes on the ground, or even new gravitational wave observatories, which observe gravitational waves directly from the ground and are a really new, really cool thing. And doing that is going to be one of the ways in which we're going to be able to get around that problem, that stumbling block, and is going to be a really big thing in the next 20 years in cosmology.
Just before we finish, let's look to your own immediate futures. Samantha, what are you working on at the moment?
My primary project right now is the Lightbird Space Telescope, which is led by the Japanese space agency JAXA, but we've got contributions from all over the world. And Lightbird is looking to measure primordial gravitational waves, which is what I was describing earlier, would give us evidence of cosmic inflation. And yeah, this is looking to be launched in the late 2020s.
So Ian, in terms of the experiments you're using, you're a little bit more down to earth, aren't you?
Yeah, so for the past few years, I've worked mostly on the Dark Energy Survey, which uses a really big optical telescope in Chile. In the future, I'll be looking towards the Simons Observatory, which is a cosmic microwave background experiment, which is going to be built again in Chile, and taking advantage of the dry desert conditions there to look through the atmosphere more easily. Part of my job is going to be working out how to use those things in the most productive ways together.
Well, there's certainly lots happening over the next few years. I'm looking forward to being able to report on it here on Pythagorean Astronomy. That's it for this month. My thanks to Dr. Ian Harrison and Dr. Samantha Stever for their contributions. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast and find past episodes at pythagastro.uk, or you can search for us on Spotify. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.